entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Hello there. Good Sunday morning. Welcome in on this 25th day of the month of February. I'm Rich Kimble here with Kerry Haskell and our weekly look back at some of our favorite recent conversations. The Best of Downtown is presented by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Guests of the program are heard every day on the G&M Family Market phone line. G&M, of course, on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden, open every day from 6 a.m. until 9 p.m. On the program this morning, we'll hear from Alan Adams of The Main Edge, talking about the hottest movie in America, Black Panther. Former Red Sox star Rico Petrocelli shares his thoughts on the 2018 version of the Boston Red Sox. Colin Fleming helps us celebrate Black History Month as we talk about three talented and significant artists. And we get things rolling this morning. The conversation with a newly announced interim athletic director at the University of Maine, Captain Jim Sedley, who joined us on Friday's edition of the program. Well, you've been associated with the University of Maine for well over a decade now. I've worn a lot of hats up there, recently serving as the chief of staff for President Susan Hunter. You've been involved intimately with athletic programs for many, many years. What was it about this position that was attractive to you?
I know that, you know, there's going to be a hard question later on, right? Because that one's too easy. You got to be kidding me. I mean, when Sue was President Hunter was, you know, given this quick decision to make because Carlton's departure was a surprise to everybody. And so when we started, you know, she started looking around, and I'm certainly right in the office next door. She has to try to figure out what she wants to do, given that there's going to be a new president here on July 1st. We're in a presidential transition. So she knew that she shouldn't be the one to make the decision. This really needed to be something that the next president decides as she or he builds their president's cabinet and their leadership team. So she was very careful about, you know, there's some great folks inside Memorial Gym, inside Black Bear Athletics. Seth and Lynn Coos, of course, are would have been fantastic opportunities. But what Sue was trying to do is go external and decide that and try to make it easier for the next president, so it doesn't look like she's anointing somebody. So right, I don't feel anointed, right? So she reached out to some people that she trusts: Walt Abbott, Jack Cosgrove, Tom Savage, some folks that are been around the program for a long time. Bounced a couple of ideas off of them, and this is kind of what bubbled to the top. She asked if I would be interested in doing this, which is your question. So I had to choke down the energy and the excitement, because that's not something that comes to a guy with my background, an opportunity like this. And in fact, I think I told my wife the other day, here's my aircraft carrier. And so I wanted to temper the expectations. So I got pretty fired up, but I wanted to play devil's advocate with President Hunter also, because the most important thing the university will do this year is transition to a new president, unfortunately, but that's what we're going to do. And I'm a critical part of that. I'll still be a part of that. But when given this, when asked that question, man, I got excited. I am excited. I'm jazzed. I'm energized, probably a little too much. Came out of the women's hockey game just a couple minutes ago, and I was pumping my fist. And I don't know if an athletic director is supposed to be a cheerleader or not, but I'm going to wear that mantle pretty solidly. So
now, I assume from the wording of the release as well, that this is not a short-term fix, that this is something that you're committed to, I would think, certainly through the rest of this school year, and if there's going to be a national search, probably well into next school year.
Yes, it's going to be, 6, 8, 10 months, 12 months. That's really up to the next president. You know, they're trying to figure out how to put this down on paper that I'll agree to. And the hard part is I've already said I'll agree to anything. So I guess that's not good negotiating.
Really shrewd negotiating.
Right at the top of the heap there. But, I wouldn't have done a 1 or 2 month warm to see kind of a thing. That's not the best use of my time. This isn't something I have to do. I love what I'm doing now, retired Navy, all that stuff. But boy, this is something I really want to do. So she gave the opportunity. This will be a discussion with the next president. I don't think it'll happen on July 2nd, but probably sometime thereafter. And she or he will ask me probably what I think. And so, at that point, is a national search going to be launched right away? Is it something that she or he will want to do in December? We don't know. But for at least 5 or 6 months, I'm not in a hurry. I'm not in the job yet, though, either. So not till March 12th. And, you know, it's Carlton Show until then.
Will you, and maybe you don't know yet, will you have any interest in being a candidate for the full-time job?
Now, you know who I used to work for in the Navy. And so he's got a great couple quotes. And one of them is known knowns, known unknowns, and there are unknown unknowns. In fact, that's the title of a book by about Donald Rumsfeld. And so, and, you know, we don't know. The answer is I don't know what I don't know. Today, I can't answer that question. And my standard reply is ask me in 6 months. The idea with me going in is to have it open so that it's easy for the next president to do a national search, and that's the direction today. Who knows? 6 months from now, but that'll be somebody else's call. What I do is, me as a person in this job, it makes it easier for that president to make that decision. And this is a job that deserves a national search to get the right person. 6-8 months from now, we'll see what that looks like.
We're talking with Jim Sedley. He's the interim athletic director at the University of Maine. This is not just a caretaker job, though, because there are some things that need to be decided relatively soon. We have a men's basketball coach whose contract is expiring. And then the situation with women's basketball, where it certainly seems like Amy Vashon wants to stay. People would like her to stay. And then what direction Richard Barron decides to go with his career.
Yeah, there are some important decisions. 2 points there is, one, I found out yesterday, so I haven't really thought all those through. Sue and I had talked about it, but yesterday morning she made the decision, and we wanted to tell athletics first before it was announced, and so that was this morning. So I haven't really engaged. I haven't had the chance to engage with Carlton about those things. The second thing is, I'm not going to be afraid to make a hard decision. You know, people think, what's an interim mean? Does that mean you're over there warming a seat? You know me, you're laughing. Kerry does too. You guys know me. I'm not a seat warmer.
No.
It's not my style. And I don't have any problem with making the hard decisions. And there are some tough decisions coming up. And if those aren't made on Carlton's watch, they'll be made on my watch. And I'll make them.
Let me ask you this. And you've traveled a lot with our athletic teams. You know the athletes and the coaches very, very well. I'm always amazed, and people on the outside who just get critical and look at wins and losses don't always see things from the inside. And what Maine tries to do with our athletic programs is so rare. You look at some of these programs that Denver, for instance, great hockey program. You don't hear much about the other sports, but Maine tries to be competitive in every sport we field, and overall does an awfully good job of that. Is that a realistic goal for a Division I program that's kind of at the end of the line geographically and sometimes financially?
You know, I used to watch Rumsfeld's interviews, and not his interviews, but his press conferences. And he was, I don't know if you remember those, they were notorious.
Oh, yes.
And so I'd look at you and I'd go, yes.
And that's it.
Yeah, that's what he would do. Oh. The answer is yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can't help but be, pleased at the weekend that this has come to me. This opportunity has come to me with what's going on in Black Bear athletics this weekend. The women's, hosting their first playoff game ever, winning their first playoff game ever, winning 18 games for the first time ever. That just happened. And the men playing against Boston College, they need 1 point to finish in fifth. UConn lost the other night. Then they get a bye the first weekend. Bottom line is they're finishing way beyond where everybody thought. You know,
had a pretty huge day coming up Sunday at the Cross.
Sunday, you know, that place is going to be rocking.
Yeah,
that's going to be I don't know. There were some big crowds down there for the for the high school games that I saw recently. But that's going to be a big crowd on Sunday. It's going to be loud. That's all the marbles right there. So, we're successful. We should be successful. What coach wants to coach a team that doesn't have the expectation of winning a championship somewhere or something? So I think we deserve at University of Maine to have that expectation. But, to your point, I asked Carlton earlier today, I go, so, which AD should I look for mentorship, a little advice? And he goes, Mark Huddleston down at UNH. He's a good man, been there for 13 years. I go, okay, what's he going to tell me when I ask him? He goes, how the hell do you do that up there?
Yeah.
He goes, I don't get it. And he'll say that first, and he's right. But some way, shape, or manner, our coaches and our student athletes pull together, and we put up some pretty darn good teams.
Well, you were with us, maybe on the Albany trip a few years back when Bob Ford was in his last year, and he bowed to Jack Cosgrove and
yeah, I remember
said,
that.
"Man, now that we're playing in the conference, the likes of James Madison and William and Mary and some of these schools where the budget means nothing, where they have all the money they want, how are you able to compete?" But that's been the story of what Maine has done athletically forever.
Well, you know, we tend to be a coach's factory a little bit, right, for some of the sports. And so I even see it on the president's cabinet, which is where I sat the last couple years. And we've got three or four folks on there that have been there 30 plus years. And, you know, how do you, we don't want the next president to be somebody who comes in for 3 years and then leaves. That doesn't do any good. You know, you don't get to see any follow through. You know, we're disappointed to see Carlton leaving. How do we get the next AD that's going to come in and stop this revolving door? How are we going to get somebody to come in and spend 10 years in there, start something, see it all the way through? And that's a tough one to figure out, but I think it's important. Jack Cosgrove, man, you got to love that guy. He and I have talked two or three times over the last couple of days, and there's a little bit of mentorship going on there. And, you know, Jack's giving me advice, unsolicited or not, but
I'm sure.
And I'm only doing that because I hope he's listening. But you know, he was there for a long time, incredibly successful. You know, Mike and Lynn Coots are graduates. Those are the folks that really tend to bring up some great programs. So how do we create that longevity and keep some coaches there? And like you said, it's resources, and resources are tough up there in terms of money.
That's Jim Sedley, the acting interim, I should say, athletic director at the University of Maine. When we come back on the program, it's Black History Month, and we'll celebrate with music from three talented African-American artists and our friend Colin Fleming. This is The Best of Downtown on Z62 Retro Radio.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's three times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free Maine State inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
It may not be prime biking season, but it's always a good time to make sure your cycle is in great shape. And there's only one place to go to do that. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor. Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts. They offer outstanding service and a huge stock. Make sure you like them on Facebook to get updates, shop in person or online at slippinggears.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
It's not always whether you win or lose, but who you've got on your team. The Emily Ellis team at Next Home Experience wants you to enjoy the best team chemistry in real estate. If you're looking to buy, sell, rent, or build in the Bangor area, make Emily Ellis's All-Star Squad your go-to team. Responsive and experienced, the Emily Ellis team will make your real estate quest as smooth as possible. Linda, Jen, Callie, and Emily will listen and prepare your game plan. The Emily Ellis team at 57 Washington Street in Bangor, shooting for your goals.
Penobscot Theater presents...
We're going to build you a perfect world.
A wounded young veteran returns to her small hometown.
Describe your paradise.
Confronting scars.
Forward motion is how you'll survive.
With pioneering virtual reality therapy.
You are not built to endure.
A Maine premiere.
You are built to recover.
Ugly Lies the Bone. March 15th through April 1st at Bangor's Historic Opera House.
You're at the edge.
Tickets at 942-3333 and penobscottheater.org.
That's the whole game.
Just for a thrill, you turn the sunshine into rain.
Back on the Best of Downtown, your Sunday morning. It is Black History Month. And this week we had a chance to talk about three significant African-American artists, Otis Rush, Little Willie John, and the performer you're hearing right there, Lil Hardin, also known as Lil Hardin Armstrong, the second wife of the great Louis Armstrong. And we talked about her impact and her talent with our friend, writer, and critic, Colin Fleming.
Yes, Lil Hardin, who essentially got Louis Armstrong's career into gear. He sort of fawned over King Oliver, and she was already an accomplished musician. She was a very talented pianist, and she was in Chicago before Louis got there doing her thing. And when Louis hit town from New Orleans, basically, he was the one who was able to get Lil Hardin to go out with him. No one else could really do that, plane overhead. And she was crucial to, I think, some of the most important music ever produced in this country. Perhaps the most important music ever produced in this country. And that would be the Hot Fives that Armstrong cut in 1925 or so.
Yeah, and you mentioned she remade his career in many ways, even in terms of his physical appearance, helping to tailor him to reach a broader audience.
Sure, he had bangs, which was a no-no at the time in the big city of Chicago, and he was kind of seen as a rube. He was not deemed urban enough, basically. He could play, well, as a cornet at the time, like no one else could. I mean, we're talking a level of virtuosity that Paganini on the violin, something like that, Vyacheslav Richter on the piano, Hendrix maybe on the guitar, Charlie Parker on alto, but like that kind of level. So he always had the chops, but she basically marshaled his ability into something, a force with greater focus. And she was paramount in those recordings with that group. When you have Kid Ory on trombone, Johnny Dodd, a marvelous player on clarinet, Johnny St. Cyr, and Lil Armstrong. They would rehearse at Armstrong in Lil's apartment in Chicago. Can you even imagine, like, you're in the next room, right? You're in the next apartment over here across the hall. You're like, oh, we are so doing some pasta tonight. And you hear that because think about this. It's not like a band playing jazz across the hall is going to be, like, soft. They're going to be rocking in that apartment. And if you could bootleg that, right? Imagine? Wow.
And influenced so many people, and her songs have continued to be listened to for generations, versions by everybody from Ray Charles to even Ringo Starr.
Yeah, Strutting with Some Barbecue. I mean, she was legitimately, like, could hold her own with, and this was a time for jazz, when it's really a sort of modernism. It's going past that sort of original Dixieland jazz band stuff, and it's as modernistic as James Joyce, really, in a way. And she certainly played at such a high level, but she was amazingly versatile, too. And she basically, after she parted from Louis, she became a swing musician. Now, that might not sound like too much, but between, like, sort of chamber music, small band jazz, and swing music, and Louis made the switch as well, but he was also arguably the most gifted player in the history of the medium. She wasn't that, but when you played that clip at the beginning, you hear that kind of glassy, communicative timbre of her singing. It's almost sort of like a slightly flatter version of Billie Holiday. And that piano is just so wonderfully percussive, the way it accentuates her voice.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown as we celebrate Black History Month. Let's switch artists and instruments as well and give a listen to a guitarist who influenced people like Eric Clapton, Mike Bloomfield, and countless others.
Well, I can't quit you, baby, but I gotta put you down for a while. Stuck my happy home, baby. You made me mistreat my only child.
Little West Side Chicago blues there, Colin, from Otis Rush.
This is one bad mother, basically. When you play the start of that clip, there are three things happening there, and I don't know which is the most impressive. You have that feral vocal introduction, right? It basically sounds like Howlin' Wolf, but minus the wolf graveliness, right? Almost like instead of gravel, we have something sourced from Lake Michigan, right? From nighttime, that kind of like dark bottom side soil underwater. And then you have that chord come crashing in, which is so fantastically loud. You can hear in that recording from Cobra Records that the studio was not equipped to handle blues at that volume. And then he's like, okay, well, that's enough. He comes in with that guitar lick, and that lick is so physical. You can basically feel it in your solar plexus, like, oh, wow. It knocks you back a little bit.
And he's a left-hander, too.
He just basically flipped the guitar upside down, a la Hendrix, and sort of cupped his pinky finger underneath one of the strings that gives it, again, this sort of percussive effect. And there's really no one who sounds like Otis Rush. I don't know if he was a better singer or guitar player, but you hear how he sort of pits the guitar lines against his voice, and that works just like wonderfully well. He's working out of the jump blues tradition of T-Bone Walker. And T-Bone Walker was kind of a bridge between swing and Chicago blues. It was a shuffly, jumpy sort of music, but here there is more percussive force in the beat. We're veering almost towards rhythm and blues. And the sides that Rush cut for Cobra Records in the late 50s, they're up there with Muddy Waters, Robert Johnson, the few recordings he made, Charlie Patton. I mean, really, dozen or so shortlist blues recordings.
And is that the best place to start as an introduction to Otis Rush with those Cobra recordings?
It really is. Yeah, they've come out on compilations over the years. There aren't tons of them. I mean, you're basically getting one record's worth. Well, I guess one CD's worth now. Back in the day, it probably would have been like a double LP. But yeah, you're getting like less than a couple dozen cuts, a couple outtakes, and you're hearing that very powerful vibrato that there's just certain players, you can hear a bar of them on their instrument, and you know instantly who it is. Art Tatum, for instance. Now, some of those players aren't, like, hugely virtuosic. You hear, like, a snippet of Lennon's rhythm guitar, and you're like, oh, it's the Beatles doing their thing. But Otis Rush was like that, and I've never heard Zeppelin rip them off quite a bit. I've never heard anyone come close to emoting on the guitar through his material with the same power he had. He cut some sides for Chess Records after Cobra went belly up, and they formed, like, a half album with Albert King that's really good. You go through his live recordings over the years. You go through, he was kind of a label journeyman. You're never going to find anything where you're going to think, well, he just didn't have it on this day. He mailed it in. You are always getting more than any money you put forward with anything Otis Rush did.
We're talking with Colin Fleming, and let's listen to another artist, a guy who had a lot of hits in the early days of rock, rhythm, and blues, whose life and career cut short, much through his own doing. But let's listen to a song that you may think was recorded first by Peggy Lee, but oh no, this is Little Willie John.
A feeling that's so hard to bear. You give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight, fever in the morning, fever all through the night.
To me, Colin, what's most impressive about that is that he was 18 when he recorded that.
Do you hear the horn-like enormity of the voice?
Mm.
It doesn't sound like something that comes from sort of the human chest, does it? It sounds like a bunch of horns locked in unison. So like when the band swells up near the end of that clip you just played, it's still Little Willie John's voice. He's a little dude, as you would expect, that rises above it. And everyone knows the more famous version of that song. I'm going to say that Little Willie John, I don't know that I've ever heard anyone sing better in American popular music. He had so much ability that when you hear these songs of his, like Need Your Love So Bad, Suffering with the Blues, they are some of the most painful pieces of music we have. And yet he's able to sort of transcend pain, and they sound almost palliative, like just the enormity of his spirit and of his voice. He was incredibly hot-tempered, and he may have been, he sort of alluded to a few of his transgressions, sort of his own doing. He may have been a pimp. he basically gets in a fight and allegedly self-defense, but he knifes someone. He goes to Walla Walla, and James Brown visits him, and Little Willie John, kind of like Orange is the New Black, like the soul version, says that he doesn't imagine himself getting out. James Brown cut a tribute for him, and true, he did not get out. He basically, if you've ever heard the Beatles outtake, "Leave My Kitten Alone," that's Little Willie John.
And are his recordings hard to find?
No, there are like three sets that you can get. You want him on the King label, which is what he started out with in like 1955, and that's sort of his classic material. Lots of covers from the American Songbook near the end, but he had like this furlough, basically, from jail, where he gets out for like a little bit, and he was going to have this big comeback, but in like 1966, which we don't really associate with like Little Willie John's time period. And he's working with a producer who does him no favors, and you have these very odd arrangements married to Little Willie John's impeccable vocals. So, no, you kind of want to avoid that, but the King material, again, all of it is just, it's the invention of soul, basically. Mm. Again, we have the blues, always with Little Willie John, but we see the blues splintering. The blues is the great American musical art form. People will tell you it's jazz, but really, jazz is based on the blues. So here with these artists, we get the progression from jazz to jump blues to what is becoming soul. But it's really soul blues. So, again, blues underpins it all.
Member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Well, you know you got to be good when James Brown used to open for him.
Right. James Brown was a lot of things. He was, I think of him foremost as an arranger of huge, almost geologically sized pieces of sound. He could layer rhythm and pit rhythm against rhythm, but he couldn't sing like Little Willie John. And so it always, to me, when the Beatles were doing Beatles for Sale and they needed another cover, they had kind of run out of gas after A Hard Day's Night, and the fact that they were going to take on Little Willie John's Leave My Kitten Alone is, in a sense, kind of hubristic, because you're not going to do well with that. But then Lennon pulls it off. And if you wanted like an indication of how much confidence John Lennon actually had as a singer for all of his poo-pooing of his own vocal ability, you'd look at something like that. Now, they up the tempo that kind of helps Lennon out. But Little Willie John is just an unbeatable singer.
Colin Fleming on the Best of Downtown when we return. Alan Adams of The Main Edge shares his thoughts on the movie phenomenon that is Black Panther. This is Z62 Retro Radio.
Go Blue!
Sir, you're here for the cheerleading tryouts?
Yeah, for the class of 82. Gotta show my school spirit.
I know a better way. The UMaine Alumni Signature Rewards Visa Card from University Credit Union. Low rates, no annual fees, and it earns reward points for travel, merchandise, or cash back.
Woo, sounds easier than a backflip.
Apply online today at umainealumnicard.com.
Federally insured by NCUA. Terms and conditions apply, subject to credit approval.
At this busy time of year, there's nothing better than a place that offers you one-stop shopping. That place is G&M Family Market on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. Fresh produce delivered daily, a great selection of meats and seafood, beer and wine, of course a Dunkin' Donuts and an Amato's right on site. Stop into G&M Family Market every day of the week from 6 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, and if they don't have what you're looking for, they'll make every effort to get it next time. G&M Family Market, Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. My company is ClearPoint Financial. We're an independent retirement plan advisory firm located right here in Bangor, Maine. At ClearPoint Financial, we provide guidance-based, comprehensive retirement plan solutions to companies that are concerned about their employees' retirement income security. We focus on plan participants. We help them strive to achieve retirement income security. We provide ongoing engagement, education, investment advice, and service that exceeds expectation. For more details on our financial wellness programs, call me today at 899-2552. ClearPoint Financial, the official financial advisor of the Maine Black Bears.
Honey, what's all that barking in the neighborhood?
The dogs are saying something.
Let's listen closer.
You know, Green Acres Kennel Shop in Bangor is more than our home away from home. They're your pet food superstore. My owners have always trusted Green Acres Kennel Shop for the best price and selection. They carry a large variety of Nutrisource pet foods formulated with the best ingredients and made with integrity. Oh, they even have a rewards program. I save my owners money by earning points for every purchase.
We interrupt this message to bring you the cats of the neighborhood.
Meow. It's not all about the dogs around here. Don't forget your feline friends. Green Acres Kennel Shop is my parents' pet food headquarters. They buy me the best brands of dry and canned choices.
Well, dear, the dogs and cats around here know best. Time to make Green Acres Kennel Shop our new pet food store.
Green Acres Kennel Shop, Union Street, Bangor. Online at greenacreskennel.com.
We love Green Acres Kennel Shop, our home away from home.
Back on the Best of Downtown Sunday morning. Well, if you've seen Black Panther, you know this is the theme of the villain, Killmonger. Movie with a phenomenal opening weekend and expected to do very well this weekend as well. Alan Adams joined us this week for Pass the Popcorn to talk about his thoughts of not only the film making, but the impact of Black Panther.
It was almost impossible to think that this movie could live up to the sort of hype buildup that it's been going through over the past month, 2 months, basically since it was announced, not only does it reach that bar, it clears it. Like, it's really just a phenomenal movie. One of the things that I think has been leveled as criticism for the folks at Marvel, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, is that they've become kind of wed to their formula, which understandably so. Like, when your formula, you know, basically guarantees you 9-figure openings and you make, you know, $500 million on every movie, you're probably going to stick with what works. But this movie is not that. It's remarkable. Like, Ryan Coogler, the director who also co-wrote the screenplay, is just a remarkable filmmaker. And he really found a way to sort of, it's difficult to explain, but it's like the structure, the basic skeleton, the MCU like foundation is still there, but he's managed to fill it with his own personal vision, if that makes sense. And so what you get is a movie that, you know, there are the familiar beats that you get in all of these superhero movies, like that stuff is still there. But you get a movie that actually feels like it means something, which, it's still a movie about, you know, people with superpowers wearing skin tight costumes, you know, fighting with one another. But it's also a movie about, you know, colonialism and the rise of empire and a celebration of the idea of Afrofuturism, which is a criminally underrepresented thing in the cinema. And you get these this idea of what it means to be African and what it means to be African American, and all of this, you know, through the lens of a guy dressed up like a cat. Like, it's just so remarkable to experience something like that, and to know that as much as I loved it, and I did love it, there are people out there who are basically getting the chance for the very first time in their lives to see someone that looks like them represented in that way on the big screen. You can't undersell that. Like, it's one of those things where it's like, it's such an important thing. And it feels weird to be talking about a superhero movie in terms of importance, but it is like, it really, really is. And I mean, it doesn't hurt that it's excellent. Like, Chadwick Boseman stars as T'Challa, the titular Black Panther, the soon to be king of the fictional African nation of Wakanda, which has spent hundreds of years basically hiding from its neighbors, like becoming incredibly isolationist because of the secret cache of vibranium that exists there, and so it has allowed them to advance their technology like centuries beyond what anyone else has been able to do, but they keep that, you know, they keep that under wraps. And so Wakanda is viewed from the outside as a fairly poor, like resource poor nation, which is, you know, far from the case. But, you know, his T'Challa's father, T'Chaka, died in civil war. And so this movie takes place in the immediate aftermath of that film. And yeah, he has to go back home to assume the throne. But, you know, he meets up with his mom, the queen, played by Angela Bassett. His sister, Shuri, played by Letitia Wright. And he also brings in Nakia, who is the lead of the Wakandan sort of spy organization. Also his ex-girlfriend, played by Lupita Nyong'o. And then, you've got other prominent names. Forrest Whitaker's in this movie. Daniel Kaluuya, who's, you know, Oscar-nominated Daniel Kaluuya. All of these people, like, coming together in an effort to continue the transition of power. Meanwhile, you've got an arms dealer by the name of Ulysses Klaue, played by Andy Serkis, who could not be having more fun in this movie, who is attempting to sell some ill-gotten vibranium to the U.S. government. An agent, Everett Ross, played by Martin Freeman. I was going to say Martin Sheen. I'm like, no, it's not Martin Sheen. Klaue's partner is a gentleman by the name of Eric Stevens, a former Black Ops U.S. soldier with the nickname Killmonger, played by Michael B. Jordan. I'm not going to go into too many details beyond that. Just know that certain confrontations come, acts from the past have repercussions in the present in a way that is really fairly shocking for this kind of movie. And yeah, and we'll leave it at that in terms of the plot synopsis, I think. But visually, it's stunning. It has, you know, it has the stuff you want. It's got the, you know, it's got the big car chase, and then there's a huge, like, battle scene with giant armored rhinoceri and stuff like that, and then, you know, some great hand-to-hand combat stuff. Like, some really great action effects stuff. But you also have these wonderful sort of interpersonal interactions, which, you know, come from, you know, the script that that Coogler co-wrote. There's also, my understanding is that the Glover brothers, Donald and Steven, actually took a pass at the script as well. So it's like you have that sort of, that sense of humor and that sense of, of Black identity. Very inherent to the story being told. And the performances are exceptional, like just exceptional. Like Chadwick Boseman is the ideal choice for a role like this. Lupita Nyong'o obviously is incredibly talented. Angela Bassett and Forrest Whitaker, are here. Daniel Kaluuya, like all of these people. Freeman, Serkis, like all these actors are really, really talented, and they're doing wonderful work, and they're all incredibly invested in the story that's being told. And I have to make sure this is clear. Michael B. Jordan is probably gives the greatest villain performance in the history of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And this is coming from someone who loves Tom Hiddleston and what he did and all that, but it's just like he's an incredibly talented actor, and what we've gotten is maybe the most layered and nuanced villain that they've ever taken the time to create. And you know, and there's been a lot of talk that the MCU has a bit of a villain problem, that was not in evidence here, because it's just incredibly compelling. And you know, the conflict just had so much more gray area than you usually get in these sorts of situations, just because, you know, it's like some of the choices on the side we're supposed to be rooting for are questionable, and some of the choices on the side that we're supposed to be rooting against make a lot of sense. And so when you kind of have that sort of overlap there, when things aren't necessarily as cut and dried as they so often are in this type of movie, what you get is something that's really kind of challenging in a way that you just don't see. And I could go on and on and on about this movie because I just loved it. Like, I loved everything about it. And the fact is that I loved it even though it wasn't necessarily made for me.
Right.
And I think that's something that's important to address. It's important in a lot of different ways. And
or is it? I mean, isn't it made for everybody to see this and to understand this?
Well, I think that's the thing, though. I think it's important simply because I think you're right. I think it is made for everyone, but I don't think it's ever been so clear that that's true. If that makes sense.
You know, we're not the prime target.
You know what? It doesn't matter. You don't have to aim it specifically at one group because that's the joy of this. Like, everybody reads comic books, man, you know, and everybody has those memories of these sorts of characters and stuff. And to basically prove some of the unfortunate conventional wisdom wrong, I think it's a big deal. Like, and that's what this movie does because, there are certain quote unquote, you know, truths about the movie business that this movie has essentially undone in one gigantic weekend.
It's Alan Adams of The Main Edge talking movies here on the Best of Downtown. When we return, Red Sox legend Rico Petrocelli joins us. This is Z62 Retro Radio.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
There's only one way Hartley's Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram in Newport does business. The right way. Owned and operated for over 60 years by the Hartley family, Hartley's offers the same or even better prices and discounts on vehicles as those offered at mega dealerships. And along with that comes their renowned small dealer service and exceptional attitude toward you, their customers. Hartley's values your business and your trust. You're never pushed, never pressured. No one will chase you around the lot, but no one will ignore you either. Hartley's wants you to feel comfortable at their dealership. So feel free to look around, and Hartley's professional sales staff will always be there when you need help. You'll like the place, you'll like the people, and you'll like the way they do business. The right way. The folks at Hartley's wouldn't do it any other way. Always remember, if you're out there looking around, the best deals aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country, at the Triangle in Newport. You'll always be treated the right way at Hartley's.
Your home should be your sanctuary, the place that keeps you safe and warm in the winter and cool and dry in the summer. The people at Penobscot Home Performance want to make sure your home is safe, healthy, comfortable, and energy efficient. They take a big picture view with practical steps and use their experience to ensure that the space and systems in your house are working better together. Contact them today for a free energy consultation by visiting PenobscotHomePerformance.com. Back on the Best of Downtown, your Sunday morning. Our next guest on the program was the Red Sox starting shortstop in the impossible dream season of 1967. Had a great career with Boston. Had that perfect Fenway Park swing. And has done it all as a coach, broadcaster, scout, you name it. And these days does a lot of blogging about the team at his website, RicoPetrocelli.com. We had a chance to talk Sox with Rico on Friday's Downtown. Maybe it was your prodding out there on Twitter that got the Red Sox to finally get this deal done with J.D. Martinez.
Well, no, of course, there's no doubt that the Sox wanted him. And, of course, his agent, Boros, was trying to get the most that he could for his client. But they worked out a good deal for both of them. Really, he's got a couple of years. He can opt out if he let's say he doesn't have two good years. Of course, he could then stay with the team,
until his contract is up. And if he's not producing or if he has a real serious injury, of course, that goes against the Red Sox. But, you know, think positive here. Think that he will have two good years, outstanding years, and then want to stay in Boston and play his whole career here.
Now, of course, he put up the big numbers with 45 homers last year, and that sort of overshadowed the earlier deal the Red Sox had made. But how do you like them bringing back Eduardo Nunez for another season?
Yeah, good. I just hope that he stays healthy. He's a good player. I mean, he could play different positions for you. If Devers struggles a little bit, they can give him a rest, put Nunez in there, and move him to Nunez to second, even short a little bit, you know. No, he's a very valuable guy for him. And you hope he hits, you know, it hits like last year. Even if he doesn't hit that high, you know, he's going to be valuable defensively.
There is so much talent on the left side of that infield with young guys, and I guess I'm always surprised when I hear people express disappointment in Xander Bogaerts, who was playing with an injury for a whole lot of last year. Are you still a believer in his ability to be a terrific player for this team?
Oh, definitely. You know, I think he can come back. His big problem last year, okay, he was injured. But he did play, and he chased so many bad pitches. I've never seen a guy go after that many bad pitches, especially breaking balls. I mean, he just, with two strikes especially, he started swinging, I think, when the ball was halfway down. So, I mean, he's got to improve in that area. There's no doubt about it. And he doesn't have the greatest range, but he has good enough range, and he can make the double play. So, no, he's a good ball player, and you hope that he comes back. That'll really help him.
What were your impressions of the first go-round in the majors from young Rafael Devers?
That was incredible. It was really something. I mean, not just because he's so young, but the power that he showed at a young age. I mean, he's not even in his prime. I would say the only thing I would ever be concerned about with him is his weight. He's just, you know, we just hope that he keeps his weight down, keeps in good shape. I mean, the guys, you know, they have, you should see the weight rooms that they have at Fenway and in spring training. I mean, it's bigger than my house. He takes, so they work out all the time. So I hope he keeps in good shape, but he looks like he can be a good one. Now, third base with him, we got to see him all year. He doesn't have real quick feet, but, if he makes the plays that he should make, then he'll help the club.
Rico, I think back to some of the great outfields that played behind you with the Red Sox, from Yaz and Reggie Smith and Tony Conigliaro to later on Jim Rice, Fred Lynn, Dewey Evans. This is a pretty talented group out there. Are they as good a threesome as you've seen in a Red Sox uniform?
I would, in all honesty, not because I played in that era, but I'd say Evans, Rice, and Lynn were just incredible. I mean, you couldn't pay them now. Imagine having those three guys now. Mm. Oh, my God. But, Benintendi and Bradley and Betts, absolutely an outstanding one. I would say they're a close second, you know, to the other group. But and if Jackie hits, boy, that's going to be a big lift for them.
We're talking with Rico Petrocelli. Rico, the new manager in Alex Cora, was a tough situation there with the changeover and John Farrell getting fired despite winning back-to-back division titles. Do you think Alex Cora will be a good fit for this team?
Oh, I think so. The guys seem to like him already. He's a little more, John was a very intelligent guy. I'm talking about off the field as well. He probably could end up in the front office someday, but I don't know what he wants to do. But he was a little, can't figure the word, uppity, let's say, to the players. Cora's more of a, you know, a guy that's on their level. You know, he seems to, you know, be able to talk to them in a more relaxed situation or in a relaxed manner. And John Farrell, who was a good baseball man, and of course he was an outstanding pitching coach as well. So, I mean, but you know what happens. We all know that they're eventually going to get fired. There are only a few exceptions that have gone, you know, for a long, long time with a team. So Hey, if the Sox don't do too well, you know, they're going to be screaming for Cora's head. You know, oh, he doesn't have enough experience and all that stuff. So, you know, give the guy a chance. Let him work the team. You know, what I think he has a 3-year contract for the first couple of years, you know, even if he makes some mistakes. But he'll have help with his bench coach, pitching coach. So I see him doing a good job.
Well, when you look at the pitching staff, particularly the rotation, is it crucial that guys like Porcello and David Price bounce back and have strong years?
The Price is the key. I mean, God, he's got to have 30 starts minimum. He's got to be out there, you know, a whole season. Of course, Sale, we figure he's going to be, you know, okay. He's a bulldog, but hopefully he doesn't get hurt. That's the one thing that worries me so much. Those injuries, man. But I will say this, Rich, that I really think, I was looking at the rosters, them and the Yankees, too, and I think the Sox, boy, they could really use another starting pitcher. And the reason I say that's because Rodriguez is, you know, coming off his knee injury. You know, we don't know what to expect. And Wright has had some problems off the field. We hope that's put behind him, and he can go out there and get that knuckleball over. And if they do, they'll, you know, it would be great for the Red Sox. But just the names themselves, Porcello, yes, got to come back. He knows it. It's a big year for him. Pomerantz, we don't know. You know, will he have another good year? He's got good stuff. But we got to go by, with all the teams, by the past, you know. I mean, we know we have some good pitchers, starting pitchers, and the bullpen's pretty good.
You look at these two teams, and it sure looks like in the East, the Red Sox and the Yankees are head and shoulders above everybody else in that division. Is it great to have that rivalry back to where it used to be?
Oh, absolutely. I'm telling you, this is great. As you mentioned Twitter before, I tell you, when I go on there, hear some of the responses from the sports writers, you know, I mean, and these guys are going at it. Yankee fans, Red Sox fans, this guy's better than your guy. Look at the stats from last year. This year, I mean, hit 59 home runs. Red Sox fans says, well, he may not hit that in Yankee Stadium. And they say the same about Martinez. And then there's the pitching. I mean, I get a kick out of it. It's great. I think it's fabulous.
You're so active on Twitter, and also you got a great website, RicoPetroselli.com, and you mentioned you're going to be doing a lot of blogging about the team this year.
Yeah. Hey, last year I did about 10, because I had a book out, and I was doing book signings all over the place. But this year I won't have to do that. And, so I'm going to write a lot more on the Red Sox, both, you know, when I say good and bad, meaning, you know, I'm not going to make excuses for them if they're not playing well, or a particular player we might talk about and say, give maybe reasons, my opinion, on why he's not hitting or why he's not pitching. You know, I mean, so I enjoy that. And, you know, it's great to kind of stay in the loop with, you know, talking about the Red Sox.
So last week it was really snowy around here, and I went to my DVR and I watched again the wonderful special that MLB Network put together on the 67 Red Sox, and I just loved watching that again. But I got to ask you and Mike Andrews, what is it about you guys that you don't age? You both look great.
I wish. All the bones are all creaky, but no, Mike looks great. He's always looked like he was at least 10 years younger, but he's a great guy. And we had fun doing that. They did an excellent job. You know, we didn't know how it was going to turn out, but very nice job. And it was an important year for the Red Sox. And certainly we had fun playing that year, winning games, and the fans came out to the ballpark, and kids came back, you know, and they had their heroes like Yaz, Boomer. And it was really fun, you know. It was a different time, you know, it's a little different now, but boy, they got some great ball players out there.
Absolutely. And it was fun to go back and remember those years and that team and how it changed really everything about the Red Sox. And you guys talked about it, that, you know, prior to that season, 5,000 people show up, you'd be happy. And since that time, it's been everything that you could imagine and beyond. When you go to the ballpark now, you walk around in the concourse and that area outside the park and look around. Can you imagine that this was the same Fenway Park from 50 years ago?
No, I tell you, it is amazing. They packed the ballpark just about every game, and fans are excited. You know, Red Sox fans are so passionate and knowledgeable, and it's true. We're not just saying that to try to make friends. It's true, because we've been to other cities. No, we never thought that, that it would turn out the way it did, because the year before, I think we got put up about 800,000 people in the stands. The year before that, 600,000. Now, it started off slow. You know, we had 10,000 at the opening day. And then after the first month of the season, where we started winning, being an exciting team, coming from behind, people started coming in, as I mentioned, the kids. And we ended up almost 1.8 million in 67. That's incredible. Mm. I mean, And everybody was happy, of course. And Yaz had this great year. But, yeah, they say it's the beginning of Red Sox Nation. Yeah, it brought a lot of the fans back, and of course they brought their kids, and then they brought their kids eventually. So it was great. I was so happy to be a part of it.
I think it was we were talking to might have been Jim Lomborg saying that if all the people who now claim they were at Dave Moorhead's no hitter in 1965 were actually there, it would have been a heck of a crowd.
Yeah, it would have been a packed house for Pete's sake. I think there were 2,000 people there. I mean, it was incredible. You could hear yourself. And, of course, it was exciting, and the fans were cheering all the time. But, yeah, it was just no people at the ballpark. In September, we were 35 games behind. I mean, no hope. But it was nice that Dave got that, And I talked to him occasionally, too, and tell him that people still remember. He's really... He loved it here.
Well, we love having you on the show, and great to know that you'll be writing more and more about the Red Sox this year. I love following you on Twitter as well. I hope we can check in with you during the course of the season.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime, Rich. I'll be happy to do it. And I'm very excited about this year. I know the Yankees are good. I'm not saying that they're, they're going to all of a sudden fold. No, they're good. But so are the Red Sox. And, they play, 19 games against each other? So
right.
They got to beat, they got another 140-some games. And so they got to beat other teams, too. Both of them have to beat other teams. So everybody thinks that you're going head-to-head with the Yankees that, that's the season. No, I mean, it's a long year. So let's just hope that everybody stays healthy and then they, can have real good years.
That's Red Sox great Rico Petrocelli wrapping up the Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning. Thanks to Rico, Colin Fleming, Jim Sedley of the University of Maine, Alan Adams of the Maine Edge. Thanks to you for making us a part of your Sunday. Tomorrow on the program, we're live with Maine baseball coach Nick Durba. Baseball writer Evan Davis checks in. Mike Lowe of the Portland Press Herald. Alan Adams from the Maine Edge with new movie reviews. A healthy active living minute from St. Joe's Healthcare. And another retro rock conversation, this time with Hall of Fame songwriter Jimmy Webb. Join us for Downtown tomorrow afternoon at 4. Gary, hope you have a good Sunday. You have big plans for your Sunday. A little snow possible later in the day.
Yeah, hoping to avoid having to shovel. That's my hope. Not really a plan, but that's my hope.
We carry that hope, frankly, right through June. So we'll hope that works out for us well. And we'll be here tomorrow afternoon. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, and we'll catch you tomorrow at 4 here on Z62 Retro Radio.
You're gonna be all right now.